Welcome to the Day One Podcast. For more information about this weekly program featuring outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, visit our website at dayone.org.
All we need do is to approach Jesus, bleeding and believing. So come to the hem of God's garment and claim your rightful place as a child of God's, because, sons and daughters, your faith has already made you well.
That's the Reverend Sarah Jackson Shelton. I'm Peter Wallace. Join us for some conversation and a message of faith today on Day One.
Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Now, here's your host, Peter Wallace, to introduce this week's preacher.
Thanks, Sherry. Today on Day One, we are honored to welcome back the Reverend Sarah Jackson Shelton, Senior Pastor of Baptist Church of the Covenant in Birmingham, Alabama. Sarah is a graduate of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, and served several churches in Alabama before she came to Covenant in 2000. Sarah, thanks for being with us again.
I'm honored to be here.
We learned when you were on Day One a couple of years ago that the church you pastor has a history of breaking down barriers. And last week in your sermon, you shared that story of how your church was formed. But how did that event form the foundation of the church's ministry today?
The congregation continues to be an open and welcoming congregation. And it formed the basis for who we are, because ministry is such an important part of who we are. Whether it's to take mentally challenged adults to go get their groceries on Saturday morning, or to house homeless families through the Hospitality Network, Covenant is committed that it will be a place where anyone can feel welcomed. From that very first incident until this coming Sunday, when we will open the doors of the church and invite any and all to come and be a part of our fellowship, Covenant is determined that it will be a welcoming place.
And you yourself have broken down some barriers for women preachers, particularly in the Baptist church. How would you describe your calling to the ministry?
Well, knowing the history of Covenant, it only makes sense that they would call me to be their pastor. My calling to ministry was developed in a Baptist preacher's home with a mom who is committed to the Woman's Missionary Union and to the work of Baptists all over the world. It seemed a natural progression for me to sense that God might want to do something with my life. So as a freshman at the University of Alabama, I committed myself to a full-time Christian vocation, went to Southern Seminary, and during my first semester there, decided that maybe a director of church kindergartens was not what God had intended for me, and talked with my professor, Dr. Finley Edge, about my sense of calling to preach. He asked me why I was afraid to pursue that, and I told him I had never seen it done. Mm. And his response was, "Wouldn't you rather be a part of something new and exciting than a part of something that has always been?" And so I responded yes to that call.
And we're thankful that you did. Well, what advice would you give to churches, their leaders, and their members about how we can address the various walls in our culture today that separate people by gender, race, economic status, sexual orientation, even religion? How can we become more effective agents of reconciliation as churches?
Mm-hmm. I think you have to look at people as people, those who are in need. And when you look at what their worries and concerns and fears are, you begin to realize we have so much more in common than we do issues that make us different. It's looking at one another with different eyes, I think, is the main way to do that. And once we do, then I think we begin to look at people's gifts and abilities and how they might be used to advance the kingdom of God. And then the possibilities are endless.
Mm. Well, last week we were in the boat with a sleeping Jesus and his fearful disciples. And in the gospel lesson for this Sunday, they're back in the boat crossing the sea to the other side where a great crowd meets Jesus, and something amazing happens again. In fact, some barriers are broken right before our eyes. Would you read the passage for us from Mark 5?
Yes. When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was by the sea. Then one of the leaders of the synagogue, named Jairus, came, and when he saw him, fell at his feet and begged him repeatedly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come, lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." So he went with him, and a large crowd followed him and pressed in on him. Now there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. She had endured much under many physicians and had spent all that she had, and she was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, for she said, "If I but touch his clothes, I will be made well." Immediately her hemorrhage stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. Immediately aware that power had gone forth from him, Jesus turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you. How can you say, 'Who touched me?'" He looked all around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, fell down before him, and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, some people came from the leader's house to say, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." He allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, and the brother of James. When they came to the house of the leader of the synagogue, he saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. When he had entered, he said to them, "Why do you make a commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. Then he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, get up." And immediately the girl got up and began to walk about. She was only 12 years of age. At this they were overcome with amazement. He strictly ordered them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat.
Sarah, what do we know about this Jairus who came to Jesus? Who was he?
He was a leader in the synagogue, probably had the distinction of keeping up with the laws about cleanliness and uncleanliness.
So while Jesus is heading to see Jairus' daughter, he gets sidetracked by the touch of a woman with a hemorrhage. So we have a dying girl and a hemorrhaging woman, both instances of uncleanness in Jewish law. What does this tell us about Jesus?
Tells us that Jesus is not going to look at how the law limits him. He's going to respond to need and to faith and to those who pursue him with insistency.
Well, Sarah, we look forward to learning more about how to pursue Jesus in your sermon today, A Daughter's Faith. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for asking. As I came into the office one morning recently, I realized that I had a large manila envelope on my desk. Thinking that it was probably some promotional materials for the pastor and his wife, I was just beginning to drop it into the recycle bin when I recognized the name on the return address. It read, "Dr. William A. Hull." Dr. Hull is an esteemed Baptist pastor and professor, having taught at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and more recently at Samford University, so my curiosity was immediately piqued. His cover letter explained that in his retirement, he had been cleaning out files. He came across some old correspondence with my father, also a retired Baptist preacher. Now, the significant contents of those letters had to do with my church's history. However, there was another pleasant surprise contained in the information that Dr. Hall sent. My best guess is that he may be unaware of the way the correspondence touched me. For you see, when I came to my church, the newspaper carried an article about the event. Dr. Hull cut it out, sent it to my dad, and in his cover letter he referred to me as Daughter Sarah. A man who is rarely demonstrative, I was touched by what would be an affectionate reference. When I turned to the next page, I was completely caught off guard to see my father's minuscule handwriting on his stationery letterhead. It has been, after all, almost 6 years since he died. So I scrunched up my eyes to focus on his tiny scrawl. He wrote, "How good it was a few days ago to receive your thoughtful and cordial letter with copy of news clipping regarding Daughter Sarah and her ministry with the Baptist Church of the Covenant in Birmingham. Sarah is very dear to me, a very capable young woman. Trust she will be a blessing to Church of the Covenant and it to her." It was like receiving an unexpected gift. It was a blessing that I had not anticipated. It was lovely to know that I would be spoken of in such tender ways when it was not required. Daughter Sarah, capable, dear to me. Now I realize that I am incredibly fortunate to have received not only these letters, but a lifetime of blessing from my dad. There was encouragement to go to school, realistic caution in choice of vocation, presence at significant events, and availability at every turn. My dad reminds me of the father Jairus in the gospel lesson for today. Jairus's bold actions make it plausible for us to believe that he was the stereotypical doting father with his precious baby girl. Perhaps he coached his daughter's soccer team, attended her ballet recitals, and listened to her practice the piano with pleasure and pride. He made sure that she was not only being taught appropriate social graces by her mother, but given opportunities to practice them. And being an official of the synagogue, I am sure that he tended to her religious education so that she would be a proper young Jewish maiden, soon to be of a marriageable age. Jairus's official position at the synagogue was most likely a special appointment to supervise the observance of the law, especially regarding things that were clean and unclean. Now Jairus has a 12-year-old daughter, and the daughter is dying, and the law was clear. To touch a dead body made one unclean. So we watch as this leader of the synagogue puts aside all of his professional trappings in order to fully be a father. It is a case of situational ethics in which he must respond to what is happening in his family rather than the narrow places that faith and law sometimes provide. Perhaps Jairus was feeling what the poet Yeats attempts to describe when he said, "Things fall apart, the center cannot hold." It was a time to move beyond the center stackpole of rules and expectations in order to be delivered from assumptions and illusions. He had to leave behind the platitudes and promises and good intentions and go with what his heart said he must do. He had to move into the place of yearning and longing because he refused to accept the prospect of her young life being interrupted, her dreams dashed, and her hopes broken. And so he uses his social status and power in order to approach Jesus. He comes directly to him, kneels, and addresses Jesus in the public arena with his concern for his child. His advocacy for his daughter stands in contrast to the parallel story that is inserted. A woman who has no identifying name and who has been sick for the same amount of time as Jairus's daughter has been alive has no advocate. The doctors have not been able to cure her. The priest consistently send her away and keep her in isolation because of her impure status. In fact, the way that she drops before Jesus, trembling with fear instead of giving a spontaneous whoop of joy over being made well, makes me wonder about the ongoing reactions of those in the community who have taught her such terror. It is important that we do not underestimate the destructive power that was in the crowd that day. For later we are told that when Jesus announced that this dearest little one was not dead, but only sleeping, the people laughed out loud at Jesus. In spite of their observance of his miracles, in spite of the teachings they had heard, when Jesus defines their mourning as premature, they laugh in his face. This is a tough crowd. They are full of cultural prejudice. They are weathered by the harsh realities of life, and grace escapes them in the face of death. Sometimes these voices are loud and demanding, but often the voices that steal away our lives are quiet and subtle. Kenneth Fearing, the poet, describes a particularly long and wearisome day in her life. Evening finally comes. The house is quiet at last. The children have been tucked into bed and are asleep. She sits in the family room with her husband, and they lose themselves in the blur of the images on the television. They talk a little, but not enough. They try to make time pass with a drink. Then the 11 o'clock news is over and she says she will go up to bed. She asks, "Are you coming soon?" He replies with, "In a minute." But as she heads towards the stairs, she hears him switch the channel to a late show, and she knows that it will be another hour or so of watching, and she will drop off to sleep, alone, again. As she climbs the stairs in the dark, she does a silly thing that she did as a child when she was afraid. She counts the number of steps. And then, not really wanting to and wishing that she had not, she asks herself, "Did you sometime or somewhere have a different idea?" She pauses for an instant. Should she go upstairs alone or return downstairs alone? And the reality of her soul's death causes her to wonder for the first time in her life, "Is this what I was born to feel and to do and to be?" It is at these moments that the power of the gospel has opportunity to shine. Robert Capone has said, "Jesus came to raise the dead. The only qualification for the gift of the gospel is to be dead. You do not have to be smart. You do not have to be good. You do not have to be wise. You do not have to be wonderful. You do not have to be anything. You just have to be dead. That's it." And so this little girl, so close to death that she has been pronounced dead, is restored to life by Jesus. It is one of the three resurrection stories in the Gospels. And the woman with the hemorrhage, in spite of the invisible role in which society placed her, she summons up a truckload of courage to approach Jesus. Unlike Jairus, she comes from behind trying to mask her presence. While Jairus is bold enough to ask Jesus to lay his healing hand on his daughter, this woman lays her hand on Jesus. She takes the initiative for her own healing by stepping into the public arena that is considered to be the space of male power and male negotiations. She touches the fringe of the Jewish teacher's cloak, who is surrounded by eager listeners. Refusing to be powerless any longer, she breaks through the social, cultural, and religious barriers that have relegated her to isolation. Reaching through the gender barrier, stretching across the ritual purity boundaries, this woman displays extraordinary faith, and Jesus recognizes it. Unlike the other miracle stories, Jesus does not pronounce any healing words. He does not recoil or regard himself contaminated. Jesus does nothing to bring the attention back to him. Instead, he overwhelms her with gentleness. Jesus does not do anything but acknowledge her. He simply calls her daughter, and in so doing, he not only gives her the blessing that no one else was willing to give, he acknowledges the power of female faith. In seeking the source of the healing, he cites it as being her own faith. Her courage to break through the conditioning of a lifetime brings her a condition she can barely remember: peace. Macrina Whitaker has penned a beautiful poem about this daughter in her book Seasons of Your Heart. It reads, "Once there was a wound. It was no ordinary wound. It was my wound, and we had lived together long. I yearned to be free of this wound, I wanted the bleeding to stop. Yet if the truth be known, I felt a strange kind of gratitude for this wound. It made me tremendously open to grace, vulnerable to God's mercy. A beautiful believing in me that I have named faith kept growing, daring me to reach for what I could not see. This wound had made me open. I was ready for grace, and so one day I reached. There I was, thick in the crowd, bleeding and believing, and I reached. At first I reached for what I could see, the fringe of a garment, but my reaching did not stop there. For someone reached back into me. A grace I couldn't see flowed through me. A power I didn't understand began to fill the depths of me. Trembling, I was called forth to claim my wholeness. The bleeding had left me. The believing remained. And strange as this may sound, I have never lost my gratitude for the wound that made me so open to grace. My friends, this daughter is you and me. I do not know all of the specifics of what your hemorrhage looks like, what it feels like, how you endure it, what others tell you about it in obvious and not so obvious ways, or even why it has occurred. However, I have little doubt that something in you is yearning for healing, begging for relief, seeking after a blessing and willing to believe. And really, the desire to believe is enough. All we need do is to approach Jesus, bleeding and believing. So come to the hem of God's garment and claim your rightful place as a child of God's. Because, sons and daughters, your faith has already made you well. Will you join me in prayer? O Lord our God, stop our bleeding and increase our believing. Fill our wounds with your healing. Remove our fear and replace it with your peace. We ask all these things as we put our hands on the hem of Jesus' garment. Amen.
Now let's rejoin our host, Peter Wallace, and Sarah Shelton for some final thoughts on this week's message.
Sarah, I loved your story about the unexpected letter from your father who had passed away some years earlier. You said your dad reminded you of the Father Jairus in the gospel account, the doting father who put aside his professional trappings to come to Jesus about his dying daughter. It was a case of situational ethics, you said. So are there principles we should draw from this to apply to such situations in our lives?
I think any time that faith or law puts us in a narrow place, a place that appears to have no way out of it, something that is so confining that you feel like you're squeezed to death and can't get beyond it, that's a time to look beyond the box. Mm. The psalmist says that God's desire is to take us out of the narrow places and to put us into the broad spaces. And I think that's what we watch Jesus do over and over again.
On the other hand, the woman with the hemorrhage had no advocate, you pointed out. Mm-hmm. And she comes to Jesus in quite a different way, in her weakness. And you spoke about those powerless moments in our own lives when the power of the gospel has opportunity to shine. How can we be more ready to respond in those moments of powerlessness?
Sometimes I think it's a recognition that we have another option. Some would say that to have faith is a powerless situation. Mm. Sometimes we don't want to recognize that we're powerless because we think we can fix it. Mm-hmm. So it's coming to a place where you begin to realize, I'm out of options, but that there is something else I can do. I can recognize the fact that I'm dead to sin, dead to options, dead to my own level of energy, and to reach out to something that's beyond us and beyond our abilities, beyond our imagination, and to ask for help.
The woman took the initiative for her own healing by stepping into the public arena to lay her hand on Jesus. What are the barriers you see that people today need to reach through in their lives to bring about healing? How can we touch Jesus' hem today?
Mm-hmm. One of the classic images I carry in my heart and mind is when I stand in the pulpit to preach at Baptist Church of the Covenant. On the same pew on any given Sunday, I have an esteemed seminary professor who has written volumes of theological information that's used all over the world. And just a couple of seats over is a woman who often sleeps on the back porch of our church. And she is disheveled and she is illiterate. She cannot even graduate from Christian Women's Job Corps. And so the prospects of her coming in contact with this man and his wife and the gracious behavior that extends between them speaks to me of the barriers that must be overcome. And so I watch them worship together on Sundays. They find the hymn and they hand her the hymnal. They locate the scripture and they hand her the Bible. She can't read it, but it makes her feel like she is a part of the family of God to be included in that context.
Sarah Shelton, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Day One brings you preachers from the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, the Episcopal Church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the Presbyterian Church USA, the United Church of Christ, and the United Methodist Church. Donald Jones is our production supervisor and audio engineer, and Peter Wallace, our executive producer. It's been our joy to bring you today's program. Thanks for joining us. I'm Sherry Miller, wishing you all God's blessings on day one and forever. This is Sherry Miller. I'm delighted to tell you about a brand new devotional book by the host of Day One, Peter Wallace. It's entitled Connected, You and God in the Psalms. This devotional treasury is designed to help readers of any age to connect powerfully with God, with one another, and with the world around us. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Chabon writes, Peter Wallace is a beautiful thinker and a deep, humane soul. This book distills that beauty and reveals that depth. We could ask for no better guide to the comfort, the wisdom, and the poetry that the Psalms hold for us searchers. Connected is available now in bookstores or directly from Day One. For information, call us toll-free at 1-888-411-DAY1 or visit dayone.org.